Robertson, the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, sitting with us by designation of Chief Justice, and we appreciate his assistance. The first case this morning, Aventis Pharma v. Lupin, 06-1530-1555.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The bulk of the District Court's fact findings below were correct, and Lupin does not challenge them on appeal. But there were critical junctures in the District Court's legal analysis where it went astray, and I wish to address three errors in particular this morning. First, the District Court wrongly presumed that the sharing of prior art had to say should separate isomers rather than can separate or may isolate isomers in order for Lupin to prove invalidity by clear and convincing evidence. Second, the District Court ignored this Court's all elements rule in the context of its equivalence analysis. Rather than analyze whether Lupin's deliberate addition of other isomers to its product was the equivalent of a claim that required them to be removed, the District Court's analysis turned on whether Lupin's ANDA product was therapeutically equivalent to a commercial embodiment, and that was error. Here, the case is procedurally positioned so that the Court can enter summary judgment of non-infringement in favor of Lupin. Lupin's summary judgment motion below presented unrebutted expert testimony that the amount of other isomers in Lupin's product were large and substantial. Lupin also presented unrebutted test data in the form of TLC testing that demonstrated that the amount of other isomers in its product could be tested and detected by the very test that Aventis had relied on before the PTO to support its substantial three of other isomers claim element to satisfy the written description requirement. The third, the 722 patent violates 35 U.S.C. Section 112. The District Court found that the specification never defines the phrase substantially free of other isomers, never describes what substantially free of other isomers is, and the specification never even characterizes as the invention that ramipril substantially free of other isomers is what the inventors meant to claim. Since substantially free of other isomers is the only claim element that has been alleged to differentiate the 722 patent claims from the sharing prior art, those deficiencies in the specification are fatal under this Court's case law, such as Seattle Box v. Industrial Crating, Honeywell v. ITC, and Purdue Pharma v. Falling. If I may, I'd like to start with the obviousness analysis, because here, the District Court clearly found it to be critical that the sharing prior art only taught the person of ordinary skill in the art that the disclosed ramipril isomers could be isolated or should be separated, I'm sorry, or may be separated, as opposed to should be separated. But that was error, and that error is readily correctable here. In Re Adamson, 275 F. 2nd, 952, CCPA 1960, never required so stringent a standard as should be separated. In Adamson, the pending claims were directed to an isomer that was substantially separated from its companion isomer. The analysis that the Court followed there was, first, would the person skilled in the art understand...
Let me just ask you, I'm going to get there or not, but do you think that KSR, Supreme Court's case, affects the outcome of this business?
I think that what KSR instructs, and I think that what the KSR case tells us, is that you shouldn't have an extremely rigid test for demonstrating obviousness. And here, I think that trying to draw a distinction between should separate versus can be isolated or may be separated, that's really too stringent of a test. I think that what the Supreme Court made clear in KSR is that the critical part of the analysis is there something that would prompt the person of ordinary skill in the art to arrive at the claimed invention. Here, when the very prior art reference discloses this all-S ramipril isomer and tells you, not once but twice, within the specification, that the S isomers and these other isomers should be separated or could be separated from one another or maybe isolated from one another. And when you look at the actual specification itself, and everywhere in the specification, it's talking about preferences for the S isomer. When you take that and then you couple it with the District Court's other fact findings that found, for example, that the column chromatography separation technique that the one that is disclosed in the sharing prior art reference is the same one that was used in the 722 patent, that this is something that persons of ordinary skill in the art know how to use to separate isomers, that it's considered to be a routine technique that can be used to separate isomers. When the district court also finds that the level of ordinary skill in the art is high, you know, that in and of itself directs the, you know, should render this patent obvious, particularly when the district court found that there were no secondary considerations that were demonstrated non-obviousness.
The district court here, it seemed to me, placed a great deal of emphasis on motivation or lack thereof. And in that sense, perhaps ASR does change the landscape.
Right. Well, I think even under in the pre-KSR landscape, you know, the test of this court was never a motivation that was, you know, you must be able to get this product, or there must be an explicit instruction that you will go get this product. But the court's precedent, you know, has been that there needs to be some reason, some suggestion, or motivation to combine. And here, the sharing prior art references, by saying these isomers can be isolated and may be separated, that's all the suggestion that you should need. And that's why, you know, when it gets to the Adamson case that, you know, came up in the 1960s, that relied on a reference that was back in 1949 that said the person of ordinary skill in the art in this field is going to understand, once they are aware that the racemate exists, that separation of these isomers is potentially possible.
Now, as I understand it, the prosecution in this case was rather lengthy, and at one point, the claims were amended and this limitation focusing on the substantially free other isomers. And that seemingly did the trick in convincing the examiner to allow this. But what was it about the purity that rendered these claims patentable? Normally, if the prior art shows a compound, even a compound mixed with other compounds, it's simply a claim to this compound in a more pure form doesn't necessarily result in patentability, absent some showing of, for example, unexpected results.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
And what was it here in this case that convinced the examiner to allow it?
That might be a question that I've left to my opposing colleagues. To me, I don't think that the PTO had a good reason, aside from perhaps sheer exhaustion after 7 years in an interference. But, you know, the claims...
It does happen.
It does. And, you know, I think here what happened is you had three different examiners over the course of 7 years. And originally, the first part of the prosecution was all spent trying to antedate the sharing references. They tried to come up with all sorts of reasons why the sharing references wouldn't get the person of ordinary skill in the art for Remicrol. And those were rejected time and time again by the PTO examiner. The examiner declared an interference. They go into the interference. Sharing essentially takes the compound claims, winds up getting the 258 patent, which included a claim to the 5S isomer. And Aventis, you know, to try to get something out of the PTO, try to come up with this distinction that's substantially free of other isomers, somehow represents an advancement over the art. Now that raises to us some of the 112 issues, which is that if you're going to say that substantially free of other isomers now is your invention, you know, where is that in the specification? And that's one of the first rejections that the PTO examiner issued when those claims came back before her. She said, you know, she issued a section 112 written description rejection. She said, look, your patent examples don't say anything about the purity of the working examples. You know, it was undisputed at trial that substantially free of other isomers is nowhere described in the specification. So if substantially free of other isomers is supposedly adding something here that's inventive, what problem was it trying to solve? You know, what have you given the public in exchange for substantially free of other isomers?
Getting back to obviousness, as I understand it, the district court found no unexpected results.
That's correct.
And I gather there's been no real they knew about that finding. Is that correct?
No, we completely agree that there weren't any unexpected results here. When Aventis was before the PTO, they submitted a declaration by a gentleman named Mr. Becker. And what Mr. Becker told the PTO is, I've made a mixture of isomers where the amount of ramipril in there is about 35%. I've got some pure ramipril, a 5S isomer that's, you know, there at about 100%. And look, it turns out that this 100% ramipril is 3 times more potent than the mixture. And the district court said, well, that's really not saying all that much. What you've basically done is you've, you know, cut the dosage by a third and you've got 1/3 of the potency. How is that unexpected? So, you know, so I think that, you know, that was given to the PTO, and you know, the PTO examiner may well rely on that to, you know, avoid the obviousness rejection. But when the district court actually delved into the actual data and, you know, heard the evidence at trial, he was not convinced that there were any unexpected results at all. And since he made a specific finding to that effect, he found there was no commercial success that could be associated with this. You know, this is if there was ever an isomer case that was designed to be found obvious, I think that this is the one. So I think
you're into your rebuttal time, but go ahead.
No, that's it.
You want to say your rebuttal time?
Yes, thank you.
We'll see now. We're dividing the argument.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. May I please?
Mr. Cerrito?
Yes, Your Honor. Nick Cerrito from Jones Day on behalf of King Pharmaceuticals. In light of the arguments we heard this morning, we were trying to debate how much time to save for each argument. I'm going to cede my time to Mr. Katkoff, and I would like to reserve 1 minute, if I may, on the cross appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Court. I'm Joel Katkoff. I will address the obviousness question we just spoke about. And the first thing I'd like to address is Judge Lynn's question about what the advantage of the single isomer, substantially three of other isomers, as opposed to a mixture. And the record shows, Your Honor, that ramipril, that is a 5S isomer, substantially three of other isomers, is 18 times as potent as the next most potent isomer. Which means that when ramipril is mixed with any other isomers, you have something which is less potent than ramipril substantially three other isomers. And that was a finding of the district court, actually, the 18 times as potent. And it's
but that did not lead the district court to find that there was any unexpected.
Your Honor, I'd like to direct your attention to page 877-78, with page 76-77 of the district court's opinion, where the court said, the court agrees with Aventis King that the evidence shows that as of 1981, there was no expectation that ramipril, substantially free of other isomers, would be more or less potent than a mixture. No expectation would be more or less potent than a mixture. How would it be less potent? Would be less potent than the mixture if some other isomer was more potent than ramipril. So if you mix ramipril with something which is more potent, then that mixture would be more potent than ramipril itself. As of the time of the invention, no one knew which was the most potent isomer. It wasn't known. And since it wasn't known what's the most potent isomer, it could not be predicted whether ramipril, substantially free of other isomers, would be more or less potent than the mixture. That's what the court found.
Appendix page 81, the court says, finally, the court is not persuaded that the evidence shows that Malthus indicates unexpected results.
Yes, and then the court goes on to discuss whether it's superior to enalapril, which was another prior art compound, as opposed to whether it was more or less potent than the mixture. So the court did find that he's not convinced there was unexpected results on the superiority with respect to enalapril. But with respect to the superiority over the mixture, the court did find that there was no expectation, as of the time of the invention, that ramipril, substantially three of other isomers, would be more or less potent than the mixture. And that's important. And Your Honors, for ramipril substantially free of other isomers to be obvious over the prior art mixture. I submit you need three things. You need, under the law, you need a reasonable expectation of success that you're going to be able to separate the single isomer from the mixture. Second, even if you have that reasonable expectation of success that you're going to be able to separate out the isomers, you need a reason to go for a single isomer as opposed to just staying with the mixture and using that.
Well,
and finally,
it's common sense, is it not, that if you find a compound that has some advantageous effectiveness for medicinal purposes, that you're always trying to find it in more pure form. It's just logical.
Well, that
drug is effective in some form that if it can be made in a more pure form, one would normally expect that it would be more effective.
Well, Your Honor, many drugs have different isomers that are equally effective and are sold, in fact, as mixtures of isomers. They're called racemic mixtures, mixtures of two isomers. Ritalin was one which was mentioned during the trial in the district court. Ritalin is sold as a racemic mixture, two different isomers. Subsequently, it was discovered that a particular isomer was more potent, and now that has been developed as a commercial product. The fact that you have, theoretically, you could go search for a particular isomer and get something better, doesn't mean that that's obvious, but you have a mixture that works and you're comfortable with that. And in this case, Your Honor, we're very lucky.
Well, we're doing this in the context of the PSR case, trying to make give good content to it.
Yes.
It sounds to me like this is exactly the kind of case they were suggesting.
The principle of KSR was you don't look at rigid rules, you look to common sense predictability,
exactly.
Common sense notions of predictability. And here, we are very lucky because the district court did just that even before KSR. It applied common sense notions of predictability. And what we have here is we have the sharing scientists who were people who were actually in the labs at the time, people working in the trenches, to whom this was not obvious. And if I could take the court through that very quickly, first of all, with regard to reasonable expectation of success, counsel says, well, it was a matter of routine. You could just separate the isomers. Anyone could do it at the time. The evidence in the trial court was different, and the district court's fact finding was different. The evidence in the trial court was Schering's Dr. Neustadt, who's a third party, no accident rhyme in this case, the author of the prior art, he was asked whether a person of ordinary skill in the art would have been able to separate that 31925 mixture that he had made into the component isomeric species. He answered, not easy to predict. And then he was asked the same question about that example 20 in the Schering reference. He said the same thing. The ability to separate different materials is not readily predicted. There might or might not be an efficient separation achievable. And in fact, another Schering scientist, Dr. Smith, testified when the same procedure, which worked for one compound, was applied to another compound, it didn't work, did not separate the isomers. And again, Dr. Keats, inventor on the 722 patent, he testified to the same effect. It wasn't always possible to separate the isomers. So the evidence was there was no reasonable expectation of success.
It was always possible.
I'm sorry?
I'm not sure that it really matters if it's always possible.
It's not always possible. The evidence was it's not always possible.
Right.
And whether they did not have that expectation that they would be able to do it. So that's real world evidence that there was no reasonable expectation of success. And Judge Lin, you noted that the district court relied heavily on motivation. Now, KSR, of course, said you still need some reason that a person skilled in the art would go ahead and make the composition in question. I'll shy away from the word motivation, but you still need that reason in the prior art. And again, here we have real world evidence.
But I think the district court from the record, and I thought the district court opinion was very thorough, very comprehensive, and showed quite a skillful understanding and mastery of the complex issues involved in this case, but seemed to place a great deal of emphasis on motivation in the, shall we say, pre-KSR sense. And I think what the Supreme Court indicated in KSR is that validity in the application of that is not required, and that some reasoning needs to be shown, some
yes.
reason to do it. But as I said earlier, it seems to me it's quite logical to find that just the desire to have a more pure form of a drug is reason enough, is it not?
Your Honor, it's easy to apply hindsight to something that happened 25 years ago, but people who were actually there at the time, for example, the sharing scientists who testified in this case, they were asked, well, why didn't you separate the isomers? We should say now, well, you know, in hindsight, you separate the isomers. His answer was, there was not sufficient interest in the pure isomer per se, A3146. Not interested. Why not? Why weren't they interested? Because they had a mixture that worked. They said that the pharmacological testing, it worked. That's a compound, a mixture. It's a different isomer. So we're not talking about purity in terms of getting rid of dirt. We're talking about a mixture of drug compound. Different isomers, but still a mixture that worked. And as the district court found, there's no reason to expect that a single isomer would be better. So why go for the particular isomer? That's the real world evidence at the time. Was they were not interested in the pure isomer per se, as the scientist, again, a third party, no expert running this case, author of the prior art, was not interested in. So there was no motivation.
What does that have to do with obviousness?
Well, that has to do with whether a person skilled in the art would have a reason to make the particular compound.
They weren't interested in it, so they weren't doing it. If they were interested in it,
I see what Your Honor is asking. This was a team of scientists who were working. The testimony was it was their sole and only interest for 2 years to come up with an ACE inhibitor that works. So they weren't interested in separating this particular isomer. So because they found something that worked, there was no reason to go ahead and separate it. They were not interested in pure isomer. And beyond that, even if you were interested in a single isomer, there was no reason to go for the 5-5-5-5-5 isomer, the all S isomer, particularly the 5-5 across the bridge at carbons, as the district court found.
But there was some indication that all S isomers were known to be more effective in the prior. Not necessarily the 5S isomer, but there is some indication that all S isomers were more effective.
Your Honor, that pertains to carbons, the chiral centers, not at the bridgehead, but rather in the cloud chain. So there was the...
Thinking now in terms of obviousness and whether there's some reason...
But you would need some reason, if you have S's at one end of the molecule, you have some reason why you would also expect that you would want to have S's at the other end of the molecule at the bridgehead carbons. And there was no evidence that the information that you had about captopril and enalapril, which had to do with the other end of the molecule, tells you what you should have in the bridgehead. And Your Honor, on this point, actually, the testimony in the district court was unanimous. Experts from both sides, and the sharing inventors, and the Ventus inventors, everyone agreed that there was nothing in the prior art that tells you what should be at the bridgehead, that the bridgehead should be SS. And it's somewhat oversimplifying to say all S, because that's pertaining to parts of the molecule which are not really an issue here. The part of the molecule which is an issue here is across the bridgehead, where there was nothing in the prior art which would tell a person skilled in the art that when it came to the 5-5, those two five-membered rings that are fused together, when you have a bridgehead which connects those two carbon rings, that you should have SS across the bridgehead. The only thing which Lupin relies on for the bridgehead carbons was a disclosure in the sharing references where there was a 6-5 ring system. That means a six-membered ring attached to a five-membered ring. It's a different molecule where there was a molecule disclosed in the sharing reference which had an SS there. But the evidence at trial was that the only reason there was an SS there is that was a consequence of the particular synthetic process for making that, and that the process that was used for making the 5-5 rings was a different process which were not resolved in the SS. There was no data in the sharing records which would tell you if you put SS there, you get something better. So again, there was nothing in the prior art suggesting SS at the bridgehead as being in any way superior or the way you go. So again, just to pick it off very quickly, number one, the issue of ease of separation or difficulty of separation, no reasonable expectation.
I don't think you need to repeat it. Okay. The problem was to fix something that you don't have to cross a field. It's your choice.
Okay, unless the court has any questions, then I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. Please, the court. Just speak briefly on a cross-appeal issue, which is the issue of willful infringement in a paragraph 4 Hatch-Waxman case. The district court here dismissed as a matter of law that a claim for willful infringement may not be based solely on the filing of a baseless ANDA application. The court made that ruling based on two decisions, the Amici decision of this court and Galactic from this court. I think once you look at both those decisions, you will clearly see that neither decision has forbade the possibility of a baseless paragraph 4 being the basis of a charge of willful infringement in a Hatch-Waxman case. For example, Yamaguchi, the court simply found that the trial court below did not need to reach the issue of whether or not the ANDA certification, the baseless certification in that case, needed to be elevated to a finding of willful infringement. It certainly did not say that it was prohibited. Even in Galaxo, and Galaxo suffers from a couple of additional problems. One being, of course, that it was not a paragraph 4 case. It was an antibiotic case. There was no certification in that case. There again, the court never said that based on a baseless paragraph 4 certification, there cannot be a charge of willful infringement.
You're arguing willfulness to support an exceptional case determination under Section 285. Not an enhancement of damages award under 284 because damages are not appropriate in this context, correct?
Your Honor, yes, there's been no commercial launch of the product, obviously. The enhancement of damages via through attorney's fees, which would be the remedy here, is certainly an option. The finding of willful infringement could enhance those damages, clearly. But to say from the get-go that willfulness, as a claim in a Hatch-Waxman case, when a baseless paragraph 4 exists, is, as a matter of law, does not exist, has not been stated by this court yet. I believe there's at least a couple of cases on the other side of it at the district court level since Galaxo, some on the side of Galaxo. If you look at the reasoning behind the court's conclusions in those cases, it doesn't necessarily comport with, it doesn't address, I'm sorry, I meant to do it before, it doesn't address the common sense and common sense actions here and the intent of Hatch-Waxman. Ultimately, Yamaguchi did recognize there's a duty of care when you file a paragraph 4 certification, and that duty of care needs to be taken. If you allow paragraph 4 filers to simply say anything...
I think that's just a vision answer. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hardy. Thank you, Your
Honor. First, on the issue of potency differences, again, back in the Adamson case, it was recognized that those of skill in the art would expect to see potency differences. The fact that Remicrol experienced some here is not something that renders it non-obvious. Second, under KSR, the facts are all here that the court needs in order to be able to find this patent obvious. Common sense shows that that the person of ordinary skill in the art would expect that there's going to be potency differences, and the 5S isomer of Remicrol is the one that was the most potent. That's not a surprise. Mixing in some other isomers doesn't change the potency of Remicrol. There have been some cases, at the district court level where, for example, adding other isomers has caused either a potentiation of one of the isomers, or it's caused a reduction in the effect. That hasn't happened here. Remicrol works just as well whether it's got other isomers or whether it stands alone, as the district court found. That's not been shown to be clearly erroneous.
KSR, of course, dealt with the combination patent in the predictable art, mechanical area. Right. We're not in a predictable art, are we?
Well, I think that we are. You know, we're in the art of ACE inhibitors. Now, ACE inhibitors, the structures of the molecule were based on this Brazilian snake venom structure. It was an all-S isomer because it was a naturally occurring compound. It was a single isomer. So that's how the art developed. I mean, this was structure-based drug design. Captopril, which was the first molecule, you know, modeled on that snake venom, all-S isomer. Enalapril, same thing, all-S isomer, marketed as a single isomer product. Merck informed the art that when you change one of these S isomers to an R isomer, you could experience a 700-fold potency difference. So the fact that, you know, they say that they found an 18-fold potency difference is well within the optimization range that the person of ordinary skill in the art could expect. Then when you get to the sharing reference itself, it specifically teaches in the specification that it, when it comes to these amino acid part substructures, the preference is for the S isomer. Why? Because that's what mimics the naturally occurring compound. The ring system that's at issue here, it's based on a proline ring. Proline is a naturally occurring amino acid. It's in the S configuration. So, and even when it comes to the other examples that Sharon put in their patent application, you know, you've got this 5-6 ring that, you know, that my colleagues disparage, but a 5-6 ring structurally is going to do a ring system where one ring will be up like this, the other ring will be up like this. When you've got the 5-5 ring system, why would the person of ordinary skill in the art want to change the isomer configuration so that it flips down in the opposite direction? They're not going to do that. They're going to stick with the guidepost that Sharon has, that those of skill in the art had, which is all the time going towards the S isomer. And more importantly, there's no teaching that says you should go in the opposite direction. So we don't have a situation here where there's teaching away from the, you know, from the ultimate preferred isomer. And again, you know, when it comes to the predictability of this art, I think that both your honors were on the Apotex v. Pfizer v. Apotex and Olympine decision. The mere fact that, you know, you might have to do some testing here or there that's routine to figure out which of these isomers is going to be the most potent isomer, that doesn't show that you've selected something or that you've done something that's not obvious. And on the issue of isomer separation, again, I think that the most telling evidence is that when you look at the 722 patent, you don't see anything in there that says isomer separation is hard. Here's a problem that we've solved in the art. They said use column chromatography, which is the same technique that Sharon used. It's the same technique that Merck used, that Squibb used to make captopril. And if you look at all the third generation ACE inhibitors, what do they all say? These isomers can be separated using column chromatography, fractional crystallization. These are known methods. And the district court found that these were known methods. So, you know, here I don't think that they've done anything other than the obvious, and that's exactly why KSR permits this court to find in Lincoln's favor. Let's see if he's got my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.